Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMC ortho.
Hello, once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop WAMC's live call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Dr. Paul Lemanski joins us today to respond to your questions and comments on cardiovascular health and preventative medicine. Anybody who knows Dr. Lemanski's work knows just how bright he is on all of this. He comes to us from the Center for Preventative Medicine and Cardiovascular Health, where he's founder and director. Dr. Lemanski is a board-certified internist with a master's degree in human nutrition. He received a BA from Columbia College, Columbia University. He received his MS from Columbia University and his MD from New York Medical College. Prior to his work at the Center for Preventative Medicine, Dr. Lemanski was clinical chief for cardiovascular health for Kaiser Permanente Northeast Division. He is currently assistant clinical professor of medicine at Albany Medical College. Dr. Paul Lemanski, my friend, my pal, welcome back to WAMC.
Good to be back.
Always great to see you here. Everybody, there are three phones working already. If you want to talk to Dr. Lemanski, get on the phone now, because otherwise it's going to be very, very hard. There are two free phones open. Okay, let's go to Mike in Middletown. All right, Mike in Middletown, you're on.
Hi, doctor. My question for you is, I don't know if it's necessarily related to cardiovascular, but I'm wondering what the effects of what sodium bicarbonate or baking soda may have for raising the pH in the body, as well as helping the heart, the lungs, and warding off cancer.
Well, I'm not aware of any data with regard to warding off cancer. With regard to altering body pH, the body's own buffering system would tend to fight any change in pH that you would want to do with baking soda. I'm not really sure why you'd want to change the body pH, since all the enzymes and all the functions in the body are determined and the function is optimized at a certain pH, which is what the body maintains. With regard to taking in a lot of baking soda, I think it could be detrimental because it is sodium, and ultimately it will potentially raise your serum, your blood pressure, and could adversely impact, you know, edema, swelling, the water content in the body. So it's like taking in extra sodium, and I'm not really sure that that would be beneficial for most folks.
Well, with respect to that, I have heard that supposedly your body doesn't process the bicarbonate of the sodium the same way as it does regular salt or sodium. I don't know if that's true or not necessarily, but I've also tried this little experiment in a small environment, such as a fish tank, and I've noticed that hypothetically, if the pH is very low, very alkaline, very acidic, should I say, in a small environment, such as a fish tank, I'll notice that the fish tend to become sickly. They get tumors, they get problems, and so on. But when I raise the pH, it seems to work very quick in a small environment like that, and they thrive. And I'm wondering if it's possible that it might be able to do that in the human body.
There's something fishy about this story.
Well,
yes.
I think it's difficult. I'm not a veterinarian. It's difficult.
But you are a fish owner.
I am a fish owner. It's difficult to extrapolate fish biochemistry to human biochemistry. I'm not sure about the answer to that question. I don't know, I don't know enough about fish in captivity to know how altering the pH would affect tumor growth in their bodies and what the implication for that might be for humans. I don't know.
Mike, thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. But before we do, I want to give that phone number. You'll get in now, 1-800-348-2551. James, Jim, you're on.
I was wondering about the environmental effects of pollution on infectious disease and possible cancers?
Well, of course, that's the $20 million question. What the health effects of various environmental pollutants are. I mean, we do know of some. There are others that we don't know about, and you know, I mean, it's such a broad topic; it's difficult to address specifically. Suffice it to say that the less pollution, the better for human health, and the same is true of animal health. Its effects on the ecosystem and how it affects human beings. Did you have a specific question with a specific pollutant?
Well, no, mainly, let's say water pollution with a lot of the infectious organisms being transferred from sewage treatment plants, and you have taken the water out of the same source about a mile downstream or so.
I see. Well, normally, in normal communities, all of those issues with regard to both organisms and toxic substances in water is a matter of public record, and you can call your town because they are required by law to test it, and you can actually see the level of pollution as compared to what the Environmental Protection Agency recommends that humans consume. With regard to certain substances like PCBs, I mean, we have some evidence that those are detrimental to humans, and I certainly would favor limiting all sorts of artificial and potentially toxic substances, even those we don't know specifically cause and effect. I would be in favor, if it could be done, to limit human exposure to those pollutants. An example would be, for example, nanoparticles that are currently used in the production of certain types of lipsticks, used in certain cosmetics. We don't really know the effect of nanoparticles on the human body, and I think until we do, we probably should not be using such products, until it's known. So it's kind of an open-ended and difficult question to answer. I mean, there are going to be some things in the environment which are not going to affect human health, but we really can't say because the effects take many years to manifest.
And this is one of the things that people talk about with the anti-frackers talk about.
Absolutely.
Why mess with something when you don't know the consequences of that?
And that's, I think we should explore consequences and explore how to do things in a more environmentally friendly way. Absolutely. Understanding, how certain processes, including processes such as fracking, how they affect and can affect the environment and the types of toxins that can be released and how those can be minimized, I think is something that should be looked at. We don't have to wait for a 25 or 30 year old study to prove that something is detrimental to have some disinclination, if it can be reasonably easily minimized, to do so.
Mm-hmm. And putting the genie back in the bottle is not always that easy.
It's kind of tough to do.
Yeah. Hey, Jim, thank you very much for calling.
You're welcome.
Yeah. 1-800-348-2551. We're going to take just a few seconds, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Bassett Healthcare Network, bringing heart care to the people of Herkimer, Cobleskill, Cooperstown, Oneonta, and surrounding areas. Bassett.org. Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York. Sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche. QFCC.com. Ellis Medicine, providing comprehensive cardiac care and preventative heart disease screenings for women. EllisMedicine.org. Sunflower Natural Foods Market, Woodstock and Rhinebeck, now taking in-store or PayPal reservations for local natural Northwind Farms or organic Cokes Farms turkeys for Thanksgiving, sunflowernatural.com. And Troy Savings Bank Music Hall, presenting Judy Collins, singing her songs as well as Irish tunes featured in her new PBS concert special, Friday at 8 p.m., troymusichall.org.
We'll be right back. A special thank you to our friend Paul Lemansky for being here with us today. It's just great. He's just got a fabulous mind. I always love talking to him. Let's go to Bill in Western Massachusetts, 1-800-348-2551. Bill, you're on.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Doctor, I'm a 71-year-old male, healthy in all other regards, it appears, a little overweight, about 20, 30 pounds overweight. I've been on a generic statin now for about 5 years because my cholesterol and my brother and my mother and father was always up around 299, which is well above the goal, as I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And in discussing with my doctor about whether I would need to stay on statin the rest of my life, he said, well, if you lose 30 pounds, maybe we can talk about that. In the meantime, I know of a number of friends lost 30 to 50 pounds by avoiding gluten, basically.
Hey, Bill, something's going gaflooey with your phone, so try to keep the same distance away from the phone as you can. Okay. So you were saying what, Paul?
Well, I'm on a cell phone, and I don't know if that's
so
the reason.
It was a gluten-free diet? Is that what he had said?
Repeat the question. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay. Well, the question is, these friends have lost a lot of weight by avoiding carbohydrates, but they eat very fatty foods. This seems kind of contradictory because I've always been told your best bet is to go on a low-fat diet. So could you comment about this concept of eating, essentially a lot of meat and as a way to lose weight and then maybe potentially allow one to get off cholesterol?
Well, I think there are two different questions there, because one question is, what's optimal diet to lose weight? And the other question would be, what is an optimal diet to reduce cholesterol? And those are two separate questions. Okay, so if it's with regard to cholesterol, I think a diet low in saturated fat, even if it did not cause weight loss, could benefit you with regard to lowering your LDL cholesterol. With regard to weight loss, any diet that restricts calories and is something that you're willing to go on is a good diet. There is no diet superior to any other, to my knowledge, for the purpose of weight loss. That said, we have used the high protein, low carb diet simply because the type of biochemistry that it elicits allows one to restrict calories to around 1,000 to 1,200 calories a day and not be hungry. That's a benefit, not being hungry. And that allows a lot of people to stay on the diet for a period of time to lose a substantial amount of weight. We're talking 15 to 30 pounds. And that's all to the good. But with regard specifically to lowering cholesterol, and most specifically the bad cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol, a diet low in saturated and trans fat would be one that would be optimal. Weight loss by itself does not necessarily lower LDL cholesterol that substantially. It will lower it somewhat, but it will not lower it dramatically. And therefore, a strategy simply to lose weight should not be necessarily used to lower cholesterol. Weight loss will alter the way that LDL cholesterol is packaged so that the body, the liver, will tend to make larger LDL particles, which tend to cause less of a problem with weight loss that will occur, as opposed to, without weight loss, with obesity, at the same LDL milligram per deciliter level, the body would tend to make smaller, more numerous LDL particles, which tend to be more causing of atherogenesis and coronary artery disease. Is that helpful?
Bill? I think we've lost Bill. That's terrible. All right. But let's hope he was listening on the radio. We'll go to Bucky in Great Barrington. Bucky, you're on.
Hi there.
Hey.
All right. Thanks for taking the call. My question is about e-cigarettes and how they relate to a regular cigarette. I guess my thinking concerning the question is, when you inhale an e-cigarette, you're inhaling nicotine vapor.
Correct.
And when you inhale a regular cigarette, you're getting the nicotine, but you're also getting the carcinogens.
Correct.
Is that correct?
So, that is correct.
All right. So, I mean...
So what's bad about an e-cigarette?
Well, yeah, looking at it from a cardiovascular point of view.
Right. So the cardiovascular risk is primarily from the nicotine. The cancer risk is primarily from the other stuff that's in a cigarette. So an e-cigarette, which doesn't have the other stuff, still has cardiovascular risk related to nicotine in your bloodstream. The same could be said for chewing tobacco. The same could be said for snuff. The same could be said for a cigar. Those will increase the nicotine levels in your blood, and that will increase cardiovascular risk.
Okay. All right. Well, that clears up the issue. But the chance of cancer risk is lower.
It's lower. I don't know. I don't know if it's actually been studied. I don't know what it would be. It's lower.
Right.
Yes. I don't know of any published data on that. I'm sure some exists. I'm not aware of it, however, but it stands to make good sense that if you're not taking in all of the other stuff, that nicotine alone may have some carcinogenesis risk, but it's certainly not going to be the same as it would be with all the other inhaled pollutants that you get from a regular cigarette.
So if Bucky's real question is, should I continue to use e-cigarettes, your answer would be?
In the short run, I think it's a useful thing to use to try and get off of all nicotine products, period.
Right.
And okay, I don't mean, by short term, I mean weeks to months, not months to years.
Right, exactly. All right, well, thank you so much. That answers the question. Thanks, Alan.
Thanks, Bucky. Bye.
Yep. Have a good day. Bye.
Yep. Let's go to Patrick in Rhode Island. Patrick in Rhode Island, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering if you could comment on the long-term use of antacids, such as Zegerd OTC.
Mm-mm.
Well, I think, when you're using... proton pump inhibitors, that those drugs have an effect on bone that we probably are detrimental in the long run. I think if you're using drugs that are the old-fashioned Zantac type drug, what are called H2 blockers, those are safer and have certainly a longer track record. It depends on what you're using the medicine for. So we tend to use the medicine with more side effects in the higher risk situation, and that makes it appropriate. And by that I mean, if you had reflux, bad reflux, if you had reflux that was complicated by a condition called Barrett's esophagus, which can lead to cancer of the esophagus, under those circumstances, the higher risk of a proton pump inhibitor would be justified over time, in my opinion. However, if you're just using it for occasional heartburn symptoms, if you're using it for sour stomach, I would probably use the least powerful drug that gets the job done.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the brand names of those, Paul?
Well, Zantac, Pepcid, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Ranitidine would be the chemical name.
So, Patrick, why do you use it?
I just get heartburn from the bottom of my stomach to the top of my throat. It just is unbearable sometimes. And the only thing that really seemed to take it away was the Zegerd OTC, and that would last all day long. The Pepcid worked for a little while, but it didn't have that long-term effect.
So one of the things that I would ask you would be the types of things that will make heartburn worse include the consumption of caffeine, the consumption of nicotine, the consumption of chocolate. All of those can relax the muscular ring that's at the base of the esophagus just before it goes into the stomach. So acid in the stomach, if that muscular ring is loose, then acid in the stomach can go up into the esophagus. On the other hand, if you don't do those things, then you may not need the medicine, or you may not need as much of the medicine, or you may be able to use a less strong medication with fewer side effects over time. Likewise, you know, reflux can effectively be treated by putting the head of a bed up. And
I tried that. That didn't work.
Well, how high did you put it up?
Way up. It drove Roselle crazy out of her mind.
Oh, well, that's too high. But it works for some individuals, certainly, but not all individuals. And I think that could be said for any treatment. And alcohol also will relax the lower esophageal sphincter. So these so-called lifestyle treatments can be effective along with medication. It may make it possible to use a less powerful medication to get the job done.
But Paul, but it's such a good question, Patrick, and I'm really glad you're raising it, which is why I'm giving it the time.
You don't happen to use any of these medicines, Alan, do you?
Yes, I do. Indeed, I do. But I know a surgeon who works on he does esophageal repair.
Sure.
And he keeps telling me, you know, I could do that. Then you would never have to take the medicine. Okay?
Sure. Maybe.
Okay.
There's no such thing as a guarantee,
right?
Okay, with a surgical procedure. I would say that we reserve, since surgery involves some upfront risk of the anesthesia, the surgery itself, you know, surgery is not without risk. Since surgery involves some of that upfront risk, we only use it, or we should reserve it, for those cases that cannot be treated with medication and lifestyle effectively.
Interesting, because I know a GI guy, Patrick, if I could just finish this debate up for a second. I know a GI guy, a very respected man, who says, basically, I'll tie you to a tree before I let you do that. Take the surgical.
Yeah, I mean, I personally, you know, think that you need to adjust the treatment to the risk of the condition. So higher risk treatment is justified when the risk of the condition.
Sure.
And so not everybody has just plain gastroesophageal reflux. People can have gastroesophageal reflux leading to Barrett's esophagus, changes in the lining of the esophagus that can predispose to cancer of the esophagus. And those people, surgery might be justified, especially when you have difficulty on maximal medication treatment, getting control of symptoms and improving.
But maximum mm-hmm. would mean that you take this and the risk is that your bone density goes down.
Well, you know, compared to the risk
of cancer.
Of cancer of the esophagus, the risk, we're not saying everybody's going to get a low bone density, the risk of low bone density, I think, is in favor of taking the drug.
Gotcha.
Under those circumstances. That said, if you had severe osteoporosis,
right,
then you're getting into a judgment call where you're comparing a potential risk. So you had Barrett's, but it was controlled, but not completely, against, you know, the risk of, you know, a worsening osteoporosis. Under those circumstances, you have to sit down with your physician and come up with a individualized approach that would take all those risks into account.
Now, Patrick, I have a question for you. It says here, yep, Patrick from Rhode Island. Are you really calling from Rhode Island?
Well, I'm from Rhode Island. I was on Route 87
visiting
over there, and there's a question that I always wanted to ask without going to the doctor, I suppose.
But you really got a great answer, didn't you?
I did. Out of all those offenses, the coffee is the only one. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I try to take relatively good care of myself. But the reason why it bothers me the most is I'm a diver, and when I'm diving, sometimes it will actually ruin the dive. The heart is so bad.
Well, you know, and it also depends upon when if your symptoms occur in that circumstance, it might be possible to just take the drug for several days prior to a dive and then not take it. So you're only exposing yourself for a limited time to the effects of a powerful drug as opposed to having to take it all the time.
Okay.
Okay, Patrick, we got to let you go. I've taken a lot of time on this question. I think it's very important, so thanks for raising it. Appreciate it.
Very much. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Let's go to John in Schenectady. John.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey.
Good.
Congestive heart failure about 7 years ago, a repeat about 2 months ago, kind of started slacking off on watching my sodium content, I think, which was what brought this second on. Now, since that, and it's been almost a full 2 months, I've been very, very careful about watching sodium intake and taking medications. You know, right spot on, not forgetting anything. But a couple days ago, I began to feel a repeat of this heart failure, and it was on a Thursday night. It was almost next impossible for me to lay down or sit in a chair where my back was against the chair, and I felt very similar to how I felt a couple months ago, but not as drastic. I kind of feel like I worked my way through it. Friday, I felt much better. Saturday and Sunday, kind of close to back to normal.
Okay, hey, John, only because there's so many people behind you, what's the question?
The question is there something that I can watch for more so than what I'm doing?
Okay, so the first thing is that when you had this episode a few days ago of heart, what you felt to be decompensation of your heart failure, congestive heart failure, you should have been seen. This call on the radio doesn't take the place of a doctor evaluating you and examining you. Let's just be clear on that right up front. Okay. The second thing is that when you say you've been very, very careful with regard to the sodium content, it would also depend on what your heart failure was due to, okay, and the types of drugs that you have had used to treat your heart failure. Can you tell us the kind of drugs that you're using?
I take so many drugs.
That would impact part of the answer to your question. The other piece is, I mean, do you go out to eat?
Occasionally, yes. And
How many times a week will you go out to eat?
Maybe once on the average.
Okay. So, you know, if we're careful when we go out, we are still going to be exposed to more salt than we're going to be aware. Okay, something does not necessarily have to taste salty in order to contain a very large amount of salt. And that includes, you know, soups and, you know, pickles and even, you know, Italian food and sauces and these kind of things. So I will tell you that depending upon the degree of heart failure, an individual would only have to eat one meal a week to go from being compensated to being decompensated. And therefore, one of the things you need to inquire is not simply, am I eating a low-fat, you know, heart-healthy, but you got to determine what is the salt content of the food that I'm consuming. If you don't know, then you really have to avoid going out to eat for a while, okay, so that you can determine, yes, now I see that every time that I've gone out to eat, and the few days after that, you know, I felt a little short of breath. But these kind of things can be caused, this kind of decompensated heart failure can be caused by other things, and those other things require you to be evaluated by a physician, to be examined, and to have blood work done, and that should not be avoided.
Okay, now listen, John and Paul, we're up against a break. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
support comes from Midwives of the Hudson Valley and Capital Region, offering women's health care, maternity care, and home birth services throughout the Hudson Valley and Capital Regions. Midwives support WAMC.com. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees, offering daily specials, 518-432-0358. Middletown Medical's Pediatric Express, walk-in urgent care for children in Chester, with a pediatrician available weeknights until 9 p.m., middletownmedical.com. Mass Mocha, North Adams, presenting Trying Out New Songs and Such, a concert by Josh Ritter, Saturday, massmocha.org for tickets. And the University Club Foundation, presenting a celebration of New York State History Month, public luncheons, lectures, book signings, and a mobile phone history hunt, universityclubalbany.com.
We are back with the fabulous Dr. Paul Lemansky, not only a great friend and a great doctor, but as you can see, a guy who answers every question as completely as you might want. Okay, let's go to Harriet in Woodstock. Harriet, you're on.
Hello. Hi. Hi.
Hello.
My question's about fingernails.
Okay.
And the diagnosis of various diseases in the body through the appearance of fingernails, but also, especially, I was very sick this summer, and I had a horrible stomach virus. And a little while after that, sometime after, I noticed these very strong horizontal lines in my fingernails.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, and I equate that with the sickness. It was a stomach virus. I couldn't eat for about 5 days. It was awful. So is there any correlation? If there is, what causes that?
Well, the answer to your question is, of course there is, that, you know, illnesses, a variety of different types, not just an infectious disease, but also, you know, problems with protein intake or variations in protein intake, variations in iron levels. There are a number of different medical conditions and metabolic conditions that can cause changes in the appearance of the fingernails. This is a physical diagnosis, something that's taught in physical diagnosis in medical school, but that is not typically relied upon by most clinicians on a regular basis. Some folks, yes, but not all. And people rely to a greater extent on lab work these days than they did 30 or 40 years ago. So in a sense, it's become something of a lost art, but it does certainly and is certainly impacted by your general health. So it doesn't surprise me at all that would occur. Without being able to visualize your fingernails, however, we couldn't give you a differential diagnosis of the types of things that could be going on, simply because that differential would be so wide.
But I do notice when you go to the doc quite frequently, they'll look at your hands.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good question, Harriet. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Let's go to Dan in Albany. Dan, you're on.
Yes, doctor. Thank you. I've read that chocolate milk will suppress the absorption of calcium. Is there any truth to that?
I don't know. Wouldn't surprise me, though. Shouldn't be drinking chocolate milk.
You shouldn't, because it's got so much sugar in it, right?
Yeah.
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 So, Dan?
So, you know, I don't know. You know, certainly, you know, as compared to regular milk, would chocolate milk, you know, affect the absorption of calcium? That I don't know. It's probably been looked at. But I think that, you know, as Alan is saying, it's got sugar in it, in addition to the lactose that's in the milk itself. And I think it's probably not a healthful thing to do, except on occasion.
On occasion,
you know, we like to say on occasion means just that, on occasion. Lately, and in the last 20, 25 years, on occasion seems to mean, you know, like 4 or 5 times a week. So the occasion would be a special occasion, I guess is the best way to put it, rather than just on any occasion.
Yeah. Hey, good question, Dan. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Right, let's go to Matthew. Matthew, you're on.
Hi, my name is Matthew. My brother has been putting butter and his coffee and tea. And I've been doing about the same thing. It's nice. You can skip breakfast. But it led me down a road where I'm not sure of whether I should concentrate on buying foods that say that they're low fat, like yogurt, or should I avoid them because they're high in sugar? I'm not sure if fat or sugar leads to heart disease.
Which, well, I'm not really quite sure why you're putting butter in coffee and tea. Would you explain?
Sure. It's just to eat a fat-rich content, and supposedly it gives you more energy throughout the day because it's a way to get energy, but in a slower way. But a more consistent.
And why are you choosing butter specifically?
Because it melts nicely and tastes delicious.
Because his brother did it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess, you know, I'm not a big believer in adding extra fat to foods unnecessarily simply for its health benefit. I think that if we eat sensibly, you know, and that includes butter, eating sensibly. I mean, normally I would say you would butter a piece of bread or something like that, put it on something. I've never heard of anyone using it in coffee or tea, but why not? But, you know, I don't think, you know, that's about 5 or 6 grams of saturated fat. Depending upon what your other medical problems are, I don't know that you want to do that because if you were trying to be responsible overall, it would restrict other things that you might want to eat that had fat in it, like cheese. It would restrict the amount that you would be able to consume and still keep your diet healthful. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, do you really want to take your butter and coffee and tea? I think other things that one could get their saturated fat from that are more enjoyable, but really that's your call. If the only butter that you get is that way, and if your total, you know, if your cholesterol, your LDL cholesterol is not extremely elevated, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing that. But I wouldn't do it specifically for its health benefit. I think you should do it for the enjoyment benefit.
Well, I wouldn't do it at all.
Well, that's good, Alan. I mean, that's good.
Thanks, Matthew.
Thank you.
Let's go to Ron in Colony. Ron, you're on.
Yes, hi. Great guest.
You're not kidding.
Yeah, he is one of your best. Now, I got 2 points, and I'd like you to comment on them.
Sure.
Recent studies now, not recent, this has been going on quite a while, from, you know, that low cholesterol levels, if you go on any of these drugs, do reduce a small amount, small percentage of heart attacks, but it does nothing for the overall death rate. Now, Dr. Hal Huggins, who I don't know if you've heard him, he's a dentist, but he teaches other dentists the Huggins Protocol.
Mm-hmm.
He believes 225 is the proper cholesterol, and even much higher, because as we get older, that's how we make our testosterone. You know, all of our hormones start with cholesterol.
Yeah. Well,
everything, there's a problem with
cholesterol. Okay, run.
We got it.
Let me just finish this to point.
Oh, sorry.
And then you can answer them both. I don't know if you're aware of Dr. Sherry Rogers. She has a clinic in New York, and I think one in Florida.
Is she a dentist also?
But she's been, what's that?
Is she a dentist also?
No, she's an MD.
Okay, yeah.
She's been in practice like 45 years, and she wrote a book, Is Your Cardiologist Killing You? Because we're finding
terrible
out
thing
that
to say.
So much of this low fat and this and that's, it's really all wrong. And the drugs are a big, you know, big problem.
Okay.
But I'd like to hear what you say is the proper cholesterol in your opinion.
Okay, thanks. Ron.
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't know about you know, some of these issues. I can say that if you looked at what is a normal human cholesterol, you can look at it from several different perspectives. So if you look at it from an epidemiological perspective, that is, people who live in societies where they don't get heart disease, their LDL cholesterol is run around 70 because they're primarily eating a plant-based diet, not eating a lot of meat.
Okinawa.
China before the recent, you know, and now Chinese are getting all the diseases of Western culture. But from an epidemiological perspective, a total cholesterol around 150 and an LDL cholesterol around 70 appears to be optimal with regard to heart attacks and strokes. Now,
wait, say that again. 150
total.
So you're totaling them?
150 total. Okay, about 70 LDL, bad cholesterol. Okay, if you look at studies done actually looking at the arteries of individuals using a device called an IVUS, an intravascular ultrasound, which you can actually see plaque in the wall of the artery before it ever kind of pushes or out of balloons into the bloodstream, we know that at around an LDL of 70, that the deposition of bad cholesterol into the artery wall, which is the first step in a heart attack, the first step in atherosclerosis, stops. So,
but isn't it true, though, that the cholesterol is only there to repair the arteries that are caused by normally...
Well, no, that's not true.
Ron, who's the guest?
Yeah,
go ahead.
That's not true. Okay, the cholesterol, first of all, you know, Western culture has too much food, and too much food, and people are too overweight, and that's the primary reason why cholesterol is a problem. But I'm going to suggest to you that from this epidemiological perspective of cultures within the last several hundred years that have been
looking... I've read the books. Yeah, I know.
Okay,
So
if you look at from an epidemiological perspective, about 150, this is even in America, Framingham Heart Study. In the Framingham Heart Study, in the 45 first years that it was looked at, no one had a heart attack who had a total cholesterol below 147, okay? So even in a industrialized society with the stress and other levels of things that we have, a lower cholesterol seemed to be protective against heart attack and stroke.
What about overall death rate and hormones?
Well, you know, I don't know what data you're citing. However, there are about 100,000 patients who have been randomized to statin trials. Those absolutely do show a total death rate that's reduced.
Okay.
Now,
Now,
that said, do I think everybody should go on a statin? Absolutely not. It's completely idiotic. Okay. If you are eating a reasonable, and I emphasize the word reasonable, so we're not excluding anything, we're just measuring the amount. We're trying to have reasonable amounts of the various types of foods.
Exactly.
If you eat a reasonable diet, if you exercise in a reasonable way, and if you maintain a reasonable body weight, then the likelihood of developing heart disease is low. I will put in parentheses, if you don't have some first-degree relative who has heart disease prematurely. And under those circumstances, drugs generally are not necessary. It is not necessary to treat a cholesterol that's elevated simply because somebody arbitrarily thinks it's elevated. Okay? Many times, you need to look at the family history. Many times, you might have to do other tests to find out whether that cholesterol is really requires treatment or not. That's why you go to a physician. Although books are helpful for you to get ideas to go to your physician with, nothing substitutes going to your physician with this type of information and saying to him, "Do you really think I should take a medicine? What will happen if I stop this medicine?"
I'm sure your patients don't have many heart attacks.
Well, you know, I'm talking just collectively. Collectively.
I can tell by the way you're talking.
Well, collectively. You know, patients have fewer heart attacks than they were having. That said, you know, with the rates of body weight increase that have gone on in the last 15 or 20 years, the heart attack rates are actually now beginning to go up again, which is an unfortunate thing.
Okay, Ron, I am so sorry.
Look,
Ron, I'm so sorry. I want to try to get everybody
in. Okay, great.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Let's go to Tina. No, I'm sorry. I went out of order. Joe in Albany. Joe, we're trying to get it all done. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call, Alan.
Sure.
I appreciate all the programming you have on the station.
Thank you.
My question to the doctor is about acid reflux, back to acid reflux. I'm 47. About 3 years ago, I started having problems at night with acid reflux. And it took me a little while to figure it out, but I think my main problem is dairy, milk specifically. And I'm wondering what the doctor has to say about dairy and its act with acid reflux and how it plays a part.
I'm not really sure how it would play a part in you. I don't know any data specifically on dairy products and acid reflux. I mean, in the old days, I'm talking in the 50s and 60s, people used to take milk to treat hyperacidity and treat ulcers, actually. That did not really work because the proteins and whatnot in the milk would actually induce the formation of more acid. So it works temporarily, and then you get a rebound. I'm not really sure of any recent studies in that regard that have, you know, looked at that subject again. But, you know, you'd have to look at your own history and say, well, you know, in periods of time when I refrained from eating dairy, and again, the question would also be, when were you eating the dairy? So if you're getting up late at night, you go to bed and you get up 2 hours later with reflux, the question would be, when was your last meal prior to going to bed? Now, if you had a glass of milk just before going to bed, that's probably not a good thing. Okay? That's probably not a good thing. There should actually be nothing, no food taken for at least 4 or 5 hours prior to retiring.
So nothing in your stomach after 5 o'clock.
That's pretty much the, you know, I would say 5 or 6, pretty much the way you should at least try it before you conclude that you can do this particular, you know, eating before you go to bed is not the thing to do when you have reflux.
No, I have it and it's terrible, Joe.
So
I
know it is. Is that how you were using
the milk?
Milk products?
Well, it could be, yes. Unfortunately, I work late. I don't get home till about 8 or 9 o'clock, so I'm forced to eat kind of late. But what I've done is, after having issues with milk, I've cut milk out of my diet completely, and the acid reflux has gone down extremely. It's ironic that we're talking about it today because I had a little incident last night where I had a Greek yogurt kind of late last night, and I think that's what caused me my issue. Yeah. But it does seem to be dairy, not all dairy. Cheese doesn't seem to bother me too much. It just seems to be really milk specifically. But now that I had this little issue last night with my Greek yogurt, I just wondered now, and I did eat it kind of late.
Yeah, well, you got your answer, Joe, but I want to try to get a few more people in. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
Sure.
Let's go to Tina in Delmar. Tina, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Okay, we're almost out of time. Go ahead.
Question for the doctor about cardiac microvascular disease in women, in particular how it could be linked to vascular spasms.
Are you saying microvascular disease in women?
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
The small vessels that go around the heart. You don't think there's such a thing as cardiac microvascular disease?
No, I just wanted to know what you were specifically referring to.
Okay.
So there are, for the listeners in general, we need to understand that the vessels that are involved in most heart attacks are larger vessels, several millimeters in diameter. The vessels the caller is talking about are very, very small vessels. It is the larger vessels that can produce symptoms that cause a heart attack. The smaller vessels can also produce symptoms but don't produce a heart attack. So I don't know of any specific data with regard to microvascular disease in women as compared to men. There are spasms that can occur in the larger vessels that occur perhaps more commonly in women. But I don't know of any data specifically with regard to microvascular disease.
Okay, so you don't know if they are linked to, the spasms are linked to microvascular disease at all?
Spasms, as far as I know, are not linked to microvascular disease, no.
Okay.
Thank you, Tina. Bye-bye. Okay, we are out of time, or just about. I want to thank Joe from Coxsackie and Mike from Middletown. We're not going to be able to get to their questions today, but maybe next time. Thank you guys for calling. I'd also like to thank our very special guest, Dr. Paul Lemansky. If we have anything like an in-house doctor on the show, he's it. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from Topperson, developed to provide relief for those living in pain associated with neuropathy and fibromyalgia. Topperson.com. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been the wonderful Zach Malloy, wearing his hipster hat today. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell, Esquire. Your producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.